This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Good afternoon. My name is George Breslauer. I'm the Executive Vice Chancellor and Provost here at UC Berkeley. And it's a pleasure to welcome this important conference and a pleasure to welcome all of our out-of-town visitors to Berkeley and to the Berkeley campus. Conference, as you know, is entitled Democracy Rising, Global Prospects, Perils, and Policy Challenges, which is a subtitle that to some extent offsets the unadulterated optimism of the main title. So we have Democracy Rising, maybe. But this conference is also the inaugural event in the founding of the Center for Political Development and Democracy here at Berkeley. Like the new center that it now inaugurates, this conference brings together and showcases the formidable energies and talents of a portion of the Berkeley faculty and visiting scholars who are dedicated to the study of democracy and political development around the world. Many of our speakers who are not currently affiliated with Berkeley nevertheless have deep roots here. Some have served our university in their professional lives outside of academia, while others received their PhDs here and have gone on to luminous careers as intellectual leaders at other institutions. Our speakers at this conference, though, are not all of Berkeley stock. They also include distinguished figures from outside the Berkeley community. We're grateful to our guests from afar for joining us, and we very much hope that you'll leave this conference feeling yourselves to be members of the UC Berkeley intellectual community. As you'll see over the next several hours and throughout the day tomorrow, our speakers include distinguished guests from abroad, including a former Chief Election Commissioner of India, a leading member of the newly elected Tunisian Constituent Assembly, and a leading light of contemporary Russian journalism. We extend a warm welcome to our guests panelists who have come from overseas, as well as to those who make their home in North America and join us from the likes of Washington, Houston, Williamsburg, Boston, and Los Angeles. Now, this conference and the center that it inaugurates are in part the brainchild of Ambassador Jeremy Kinsman, who is currently a resident international scholar at the Institute for Governmental Studies here at Berkeley, and formerly the Canadian ambassador to the Russian Federation, Canadian ambassador to the European Union, and Canadian High Commissioner to the United Kingdom. Ambassador Kinsman has been instrumental in pulling us together for this occasion, and we're grateful to him for his organizational efforts, as well as for his service as a participant in two panels at this conference. Now, diplomats are usually exceedingly well-spoken, but very occasionally, they may leave you feeling that they didn't really have much that they felt they could say. Well, as you're about to see, Jeremy is an exception to this. He is a great diplomat, but anyone who has heard him speak knows that diplomats need not be bland. They can be as outspoken and as trenchant in their assessments as can any professional social scientist or journalist. We're also grateful to another current visiting scholar at the Institute for Governmental Studies, Alan Unger, for his superb organizational efforts, which were key to making this gathering possible. For organizational work, we're also indebted to Larry Michalak, an affiliate of our Center for Middle Eastern Studies here at Berkeley and a leading expert on Tunisia. Larry will speak on tomorrow morning's panel on the remarkable experience of Tunisia and on Tunisia's role as a leading force in the Arab Spring and in the political transformations that are reshaping the Middle East and North Africa. Now, I myself am a specialist on Russia and before that on the Soviet Union. I'm a political scientist and a comparativist. So I take special pleasure in opening an event that includes a substantial Russia component and that delves into comparison between lands of the former USSR and those of the Middle East and North America. I'll be chairing one of the Russia panels tomorrow afternoon, and as time allows for me, I look forward to listening in on the panels and roundtables today and tomorrow. Welcome again to Berkeley, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, and this will be the last of the inaugural speeches setting up the program. My name is Pradeep Chibber. I'm the director of the Institute of International Studies, and in collaboration with the Institute of Governmental Studies, whose director, Jack Citrin, had to step away for a moment. So I'm going to say thanks on behalf of both of us. I'd like to welcome you. This is the first in a series of collaborations between IGS and IIS, and there's more coming. In fact, we're working closely together on a number of things, including political inequality, democratic inclusion, etc., but those are events which will happen in the coming months and years. So at IGS and IIS, we're trying to bridge this gap between the U.S. and non-U.S. cases, as you would have in the social sciences, and we're trying to see what one can learn from each other. My job here is just to reiterate what the provost said. Thank you for coming, welcoming all of you, and I look forward to listening. But I also have one more important task, which is to thank the myriads of people who made this possible. George has done a great job thanking Jeremy Kinsman and Alan Unger, whose indefatigable energy actually made this possible, if I can ever speak a word with that many syllables. I'd also like to thank a number of other people, including Nazar El Said from the Center for Middle Eastern Studies, Jeff Pennington from the Institute for Slavic, East European, and Eurasian Studies. I always remember there are three E's in it. David Garren from the Miller Institute and the Law School, and the Religion, Politics, and Globalization Program. Steve Fish for many other things as well. To the staff at the Institute of Government Studies, particularly Catherine Nguyen for putting in all the work that made this possible. I just have one logistics announcement. At some point during each panel, there will be a commercial break. The reason being that the videographer needs to change the videotapes every 1 hour. So the videographer will raise his or her hand. The speaker will be asked to stop. It'll take 25 seconds. We'll play the UC Berkeley fight song. And after that, we'll get back to the panel. So with that, Steve and Jeremy, the floor is yours. Thank you.
How do you do, and thank you for coming. I'm Jeremy Kinsman. I think this says I'm... No, it does say I'm Jeremy Kinsman. I was about to say I'd rather be Steve Fish, but there you are. If I may say one thing, I was a career diplomat, an ambassador, and I'm now, through the generosity of Berkeley's spirit, part of the family here, and I thought it very important to underline my very deep sorrow at the murder yesterday of Ambassador Stevens. I just wanted to say that in this place. He was probably many times in this room. You know, people make fun of ambassadors, and not without reason sometimes. But this young guy was a different kind of ambassador for your country. and indeed on instruction. He was out in the street among the people, connecting and showing what a good American is. He wasn't traveling in a helicopter limousine bubble. He was doing what modern ambassadors have to do. He was practicing what we call public diplomacy. His accreditation, by tradition, was to the host country authorities. But in virtual reality, his accreditation was to the people in Libya. And that is what he was trying to do. And you know, it's tragic. Bob Legama met him 3 months ago and was telling me, of course, that he had had a posting in Libya, spoke Arabic. At the beginning of the nonviolent protests in Benghazi 2.5 years ago or 2 years ago, when Benghazi became actually a separate enclave, when they took the city, he was positioned in, I think via a submarine.
A small boat.
And he was with them from the start. And as the uprising proceeded, and you know the rest of that story, he stayed with them and then became the ambassador. So the cruel irony of this is that a man who was really Libya's best friend was killed there, probably because he was. That's probably the reason. Anyway, I wanted to start by saying that, and thank you. I direct a support for the project in democracy support for the Community of Democracies. We have been doing this research project, which is evidence-based, interview-based, for the last 5 years. And I will provide you with, as context for this meeting, some of its findings. I don't think what I'm going to say is going to astonish any of you. I think most of these things are common ground, but they do provide something of a framework. First of all, the big picture. Since 1973, we've gone to 194 countries in the world, and the number of so-called free countries have gone from 29% to 43%. The number of clearly autocratic countries have declined from 42 to 29. If you put it in population terms, our population's around 7 billion. 1992, 25% of us, or 1.3 billion people, were so-called free. Today, 43%, or 3 billion. 1.7 billion is a lot of good work. The last 2 years, of course, have been global game changers. There's been an overall reversal of the trend line that Freedom House identified in 2010. Freedom House had seen that the trend line forward had stopped and moved backward. They call it a democratic recession. For the first time, for the fourth year in a row, retreats from democracy outstripped gains. But what happened in Tunisia, in Egypt, Bahrain, maybe, Yemen, probably Libya, and maybe what's happening in Syria, have given a lie to the notion that aspirations to democracy are culture-specific or region-specific. In Arab societies which have experienced uprisings, the countries I mentioned, there's much greater self-confidence. In others, however, which haven't experienced the uprisings, there is impatience radiated by Al Jazeera, particularly among young people whose isolation has ended, but there's great caution among older citizens. I take a look at the Gallup poll released this week. It shows a major divide in confidence between the populations of countries which have experienced uprisings, which have changed regimes, Tunisia, Libya, Yemen, and Egypt, who have high confidence with respect to the future on security and safety, on economic progress, and on good governance. In all four Over 70% believe that security and governance will improve. And on economic performance, only Egypt is a kind of outlier at 41%. However, in the other countries where regimes have not been changed, Morocco, Algeria, the occupied territories, especially Jordan, optimism on all of these points is below 40%. Outside, there's been positive contagion from Tahrir Square. I've been to Moscow recently, and you'll hear about Russia. What happened this winter in Russia wasn't because of Tahrir Square, but what people in Tahrir Square were claiming, dignity, transparency, fairness, were very much the things that Russians in the streets of Moscow were claiming. You know, in Africa, there are going to be 23 multi-party elections this year. Several other autocracies are under very heavy street protest right now in Gabon and Togo. Elsewhere, in other parts of the world, other autocracies, including Burma and probably Cuba, are loosening up. Negative reactions, especially to unintended violent consequences, are also happening. There are counter-democracy trends right across the Sahel, from Mauritania to northern Nigeria. And in contrast to the way the Burmese junta responded to the fates of Gaddafi and Mubarak and to violent revolts, some hardline regimes have decided to clamp down instead of loosening up. I think of Iran, Uzbekistan, China, and of course President Assad in Syria. U.S. public opinion. You know, the Arab Spring initially revived the U.S. public interest from a low of disinterest caused by the overextension of the freedom agenda in the last administration and disappointment in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the combination of recession worries in this country and the more or less disastrous 80% cut in foreign news coverage in electronic and print media has kind of dampened that initial positive effect. I wonder about the impact of the Libyan killing of Ambassador Stevens. It's probably a negative for U.S. public opinion about democracy rising. I find that in the last 2 days, comment and understanding has just generalized across the area and has generalized with respect to its focus on U.S. national security. There's a tendency not to differentiate Libya. Libya was singularly unprepared for inclusive democratic governance from its neighbors. It wasn't a reason to delay it, but they simply did not have the building blocks. And it shows what extremists can do to the agenda in both countries. Jihadists, long suppressed by dictators, are not free to operate, but they're operating with many fewer constraints. And as I said, a byproduct that is sad is that it could discourage the emerging trend for U.S. ambassadors to be out and around the people rather than in the bubble. Our project is about understanding change and helping democracies to understand change. Let me just cover some points of conclusion that we have come to. On uprisings, you know, it's odd, it's interesting that from 1949 to 1973, uprisings almost always installed communist regimes, leftist regimes, China, Iran, Guatemala, Cuba, Vietnam, Cambodia. But since 1973, over 60 democratic uprisings have occurred. They're anti-authoritarian. Philippines, South Africa, Haiti, Indonesia, or plainly anti-communist from 1989 and continuing, Georgia, Kyrgyzstan. And they don't go communist. And the question is, how many will go Islamist? But whatever, ever since 1973, they've always taken policy analysts and experts by surprise, most recently in Tunisia and Egypt. Democracies have had a habit of fearing the consequences of change, which contributed probably to our overcommitment historically to the status quo. There's been a tendency to equate the status quo to stability and hence to security. And we spent years of making false choices because of this. Dictators or hostile Islamists. We deferred our values to overriding interests. The Cold War or the War on Terror. Obviously, uprisings shouldn't surprise because public opinion prepares itself over time, before they happen. Shared awareness is driven usually by perception of unfairness rather than in favor of democracy as such. Anyway, when do popular uprisings succeed? When they're bottom-up. When there's a minimum income level is probably about $1,500 a year, which would be Indonesia or Egypt. Not for its own sake, but because it signifies key enabling features such as a middle class, internet fluency, and above all, a more or less robust civil society. There are contradictions. Some oil-rich societies can be bought off. Wealthy Libya's transitional difficulties indicate, as I said, zero prior experience with personal empowerment, civil society. Our study shows that over time, nonviolence is usually a more effective approach. Regimes with guns can always out-violence protesters. And critical is the role of armies. When they refuse to shoot protesters, Moscow in 91, Kiev, Tunisia, Cairo, uprisings usually succeed. When armies do shoot, as in Tiananmen or Rangoon, or through paramilitaries like the Revolutionary Guards in Iran, they're usually suppressed. And Syria right now is a challenging anomaly. The incredible braveness of those students saying, sniper, sniper, here is my neck, here is my head. It's almost unfathomable. Of course, after uprisings come the hard part, transitions. It's a fact that uprising leaders generally don't do the transition part very well. It makes capacity building vital before and after. Patience is required. Democracy is behavioral. It's complex. It takes decades to build capacity. Reinforcement of our knowledge is important that each trajectory is different. Our role, listening more, asserting less, it's not about us. Democracy can't be exported. We're not norm givers to norm takers as we thought we were in Russia in the 90s. And it's not about markets as it was then there. Though there are obvious cross benefits between inclusive economic institutions and inclusive political institutions. Above all, the rule for democracies is do no harm. Don't take sides. The negative reaction to outside aid to political parties in recent years, to advocacy groups, has encouraged donors to shift much more from that to capacity building support. But the big lesson is that you can do two things at once. As the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Michael McFaul, formerly of Stanford, told me in February, that dual track is the rule now. You can have a strategic partnership and you can support human rights defense. On the ground, what works? You know, elections, free and fair, are only one of several starting points. It's a precondition, but too often in the 90s, we treated it as the goal itself. Managing inclusive pluralism, post-election, rooted in law, much more than sectarian conflict, though reconciling democracy and religion is vital to the countries that we're going to be talking about. Transition to inclusive pluralism needs a strong central state as a guarantor. I mean, Somalia is pluralist, but it's completely anarchic. Again, civil society is the building block. And generally, it's consistent with higher incomes, presence of a middle class, and access to communications technologies. But our research shows that though we make much of the social networks, actually people make revolutions, not technologies. There's a need for consensus. There's a need for a buy-in to the democracy project from the most powerful in society. the whole notion of pacting of old and new orders that we'll be discussing in coalition building. The authoritarian coalition, and this isn't the West against the rest, but there is an authoritarian coalition who thought that their lure of irresistible charm of authoritarian growth was making great progress because of their promise of economic development and security, prosperity, though rarely inclusive, without loss of political control. But it's increasingly clear, and I think particularly of China, that they're only really able to deliver on what is called hardware, which is technical education, health, which is important, physical infrastructure, but not on vital software, leadership, fairness, attention to youth, innovation, a society that asks questions and makes connections. But their attention to counter technology is fierce, and their mentoring of each other continues. Though increasingly, I think, people are seeing that their regimes are possibly sacrificing the next stage of development. Just to close, a few policy trends. The responsibility to protect is not about democracy, but it is about observing or recognizing that in some cases the principle of protection wins over the traditional principles of non-intervention. However, there is dissent about this, including from very major democracies for largely historic reasons. I think of India, Brazil, South Africa. They're skeptical about the misuse of the responsibility to protect. Russians today feel very duped by the process that occurred in Libya. And I make this point because despite that, the notion of universal justice is nonetheless changing behavior. The notion, the existence of an international criminal court based on universal justice is changing behavior. The absence of the United States from that court, of course, is a deep deception to many. But I do believe that's one of the things that has influenced the change in behavior in Burma. The State Department in Washington has changed behavior. It called for much more outreach to non-state actors, to civil society, dual tracks. The extent to which, of course, this is going to survive the Libyan tragedy has to be seen. The biggest lesson for democracies is that of consistency. So that behavior toward one country is not manifestly so distinct from behavior to other countries. That strategic partnerships and democracy development support can be sustained at the same time. Another lesson is that donor democracies have to accompany democracy projects for the long haul of concrete support for transitioning democracies to help them to deliver. Because if they don't deliver in economic, security, and governance terms, they're not going to survive. Ultimately, I guess, where governments of democratic countries are moving toward is, with respect to aid, it's more for more. More aid for more democracy, and less for less. But there needs to be clear, absolute clarity on the rules and on expectations. That's my report to you, and I pass it now to Steve. Thank you.
Is this on? Okay. Thank you so much, Jeremy. That was a terrific introduction. Jeremy is a statesman, and I'm just a rank-and-file political scientist. So I'm going to step back and look at some of the same issues that he did from a very on-the-ground and realistic perspective and treat these issues from a more theoretical perspective. And as a scholar, step back and ask, what have we learned as scholars that maybe we can share with non-scholars over the last 30 years or so? You know, intense study of democracy, of democratization, of new democracies has been going on for about 3 decades now. And I think it's time to step back and actually take stock of what we've actually learned. One thing we've learned is that socioeconomic development does seem to matter. Seymour Martin Lipset, in a classic piece written in 1960, said that there is a very tight correlation between how rich a country is and its chances of being a democracy. And for the most part, that generalization continues to hold. It seems like the passage of time has confirmed that big hypothesis. Now, we know much more than we did when Lipset wrote his article, his classic piece, about the causal links, about why, in fact, richer countries tend to be better at sustaining democracy than poor countries. We also know that there are many exceptions, many outliers. There are many poor democracies in the world, probably a score of countries whose per capita incomes are in the low thousands of dollars are full-fledged democracies. There are some richer countries, including Russia, which are not democracies, Belarus, Singapore. So there are many exceptions, but for the most part, there is a correlation. But as the eminent Cornell political scientist Valerie Bunce has noted, that's pretty much where general agreement ends. Kind of, we know that this generalization that was uttered by Lipset 50 years ago probably holds water. But after that, we're still arguing over about what actually causes democracy and autocracy. But there's some factors now that factor fairly largely into our assessments that I'd like to discuss, and I think they're very relevant to our discussions, particularly the regions we're going to be covering tomorrow. First of all, let's start off with oil. There's a big debate over whether oil is a bane to democracy or not. I think on the whole, though, something resembling a scholarly consensus is developing that oil is, in fact, bad for democracy. It's bad in many different ways. And again, this is not a subtle issue, but for the most part, hydrocarbons dependence, economic dependence on hydrocarbons, tends to disfavor democracy. And there are many reasons for this. On the one hand, oil creates what's oftentimes called a rentier effect. Jeremy alluded to this in his comments, where oil states are able, if oil revenues per capita are high enough, to actually buy off the population. If you're a Kuwaiti citizen, it might be harder to get excited about self-government if the government is cutting you a check for the price of a down payment on an apartment in Kuwait City when you turn 21 years old. So goes the argument that people can be anesthetized by policies that involve high social service provision and very little taxation, okay, a so-called rentier effect. There's also a repression effect. Some states that in the absence of enormous oil rents could not afford a sophisticated, massive repressive apparatus are in fact able to afford it. We see this very starkly in a country like Iran, and are able to repress what elements of the population cannot be bought off. So that repression effect is there as well. There's also what sometimes economists and political scientists call a truncated modernization effect. Modernization, we know, is consistent with democracy, consistent with what I just said about Lipset and his hypothesis. On the other hand, modernization happens differently in countries that are oil-rich than in other countries. So, for example, Saudi Arabia has a per capita income that puts it on a kind of Southern European level, and yet something like a quarter of all Saudi women are still illiterate. So, I mean, you get a different kind of modernization where it's actually fueled by oil. And there are other effects as well. There's a kind of external attention effect. Countries that have a lot of hydrocarbons tend to get a lot of external attention, a lot of it not benign, a lot of it very self-interested and sometimes malign. And this actually can have a bad effect on democratization as well. There's a corruption effect. There's just so much to steal in oil states that elites tend to be, there's more to steal, so corruption tends to fuel corruption. When elites who perhaps at the onset of democracy were in favor of open politics become rich through nefarious means, their interest in open politics tends to wane. I've watched this happen in Russia. And ordinary folks tend to begin to associate democracy with kleptocracy, with massive theft, This is not good for democratization either. So there are many ways in which oil can actually undermine the prospects for democracy. Now, I think this factor is going to lurk and should lurk in our discussions tomorrow when we talk about the Middle East and about the post-communist region. The post-communist region has several super petrostates: Russia, predominantly, but also Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and many countries in the post-communist region, of course, are oil importers. Similarly, in the Middle East, Iraq, Iran, Algeria, Libya, these are major oil producers and oil exporters, but many other countries in the Middle East, including Tunisia and Morocco, are not petrostates. What difference is this going to actually make? Is robust democracy in Russia really impossible? Just for structural reasons, just because it is a petrostate, two-thirds or three-quarters of whose export income comes from oil and natural gas. Does that render democracy in Russia virtually impossible? Does Tunisia's paucity of hydrocarbons give it a perhaps hidden advantage in democracy? Does Tunisia's neighbor Libya face much longer odds in its efforts to democratize by virtue of the fact that it's an oil-based economy? Or will Libya show that oil and robust democratization can go together? And, you know, this is a question in other regions as well. Let's take a couple of countries outside of the regions we're going to be looking at specifically in this conference and consider them. There's a terrific natural experiment developing now for those who are interested in democratization in Africa and in Inner Asia. Two of the great stars of third wave democratization, that is democratization that began in the mid-1970s and that continues to the present day, are Ghana and Mongolia. Ghana's really the shining star of West African democracy in many ways. It underwent successful democratization two decades ago, and Ghana remains now a vigorous multi-party democracy. Mongolia, in Inner Asia, among all post-communist countries, is the one that's really maintained open politics. What's interesting is, 20 years ago, when these countries underwent democratization, they were net oil importers. They didn't have much oil. They didn't have much of anything the world really cared about in terms of raw materials. Now they've struck oil. Now, the question is, can oil actually mix with democracy in these countries? Will Mongolia and Ghana be like Norway? Will they show that if you've had democracy for a couple of decades, before you strike hydrocarbons, before you get the oil and natural gas, you can maintain your democracy despite the hydrocarbons? Or, like Russia, will they show that robust democratization and oil do not mix? What about religion and religious tradition? When we talk about culture and its influence on the prospects for open politics, we very often end up talking about religion. We tend to forget in highly secular societies that religion is culture for most people in the world, whether they're believers or not. Religion is certainly a very important determinant of culture. We know among predominantly Muslim countries that there is a general trend that would show us that predominantly Muslim countries tend to lag on democratization. This is just an empirical fact right now. If we look at the post-communist world, most predominantly Muslim countries have failed in democratization. All countries in Central Asia, Azerbaijan. There's some good news in Albania. Albania has done relatively well in democracy. Doesn't get much attention. That is a predominantly Muslim country. But for the most part, within the post-communist world, predominantly Muslim societies don't do all that well. But does the Arab experience and does the Arab Spring and particularly the Tunisian experience now blow apart our notions of the relationship between Islam and democracy? This notion that Muslims and particularly Arabs are uniquely immune to democracy's charms was very popular until about 18 months ago. All right. Then some stuff happened in Tunisia that showed that, wait a minute, maybe these folks care about their freedom as well. And it was very interesting to note many social scientists and many pundits, many journalists have been saying for years that, you know, Muslims actually, they care about good things that the rest of us care about. But you see, it's not freedom they care about. It's justice. Right. It's justice. But what's interesting is these people in Tahrir Square, the folks who made the revolution in Tunisia, the folks who are making the revolution in Libya, are holding up signs and telling journalists, we want freedom. We can tell this is really not just about bread prices. Of course, underlying trends in world food prices, of course, the big political economy issues are of some importance. But what people are calling for is their political freedom, their political rights. That's what they're excited about right now. It's not just about a better standard of living. It's not just about a better distribution of income. It's about freedom. The notion that Arabs are somehow uniquely immune to the charms of political freedom has, in fact, been blown out of the water by the Arab Spring, particularly by the Tunisian experience. We also know that predominantly Muslim countries can be democracies and can undergo robust, sustained democratization. Indonesia shows that. The question now is, I think for us, and this is where the Arab Spring is so important, is in probabilistic terms, are countries that are predominantly Muslim in their populations still less prone than non-Muslim societies to undertake robust democratization? We don't know. I mean, this is an open question right now. The fate of the democratic experiments in the likes of Tunisia and Libya and Egypt is actually going to radically shift our perceptions on that question, whatever they are right now. And this, of course, is something we'll be talking about as we go on in this conference. Finally, let me say a word or two about institutions. Institutions are by definition the work of human hands rather than structural background factors. And I think there's a consensus developing among social scientists who study democracy over the last couple of decades in particular that institutions really do matter, that constitutions matter, that where power is vested in government agencies really matters. Let me pick one area where I think institutions are particularly important, and that is the power of the national legislature. I have found in some recent statistical work with Catherine Michael, who is a co-author of mine on this piece, that the probability of a country actually succeeding in undergoing democratization depends vitally on the power of the national legislature. And in fact, the predicted probability, we ran some numbers, on Tunisia escaping from autocracy, that is, escaping from that not free category that Freedom House has created to describe countries that score at the very bottom of its Freedom House score range, the probability of Tunisia becoming a democracy, of an avoiding autocracy in the future doubles if one just introduces a simple yes or no variable. Will the president have decree power or not? If the answer is no, if the legislature will monopolize the right to make laws, if the executive will not enjoy decree power, the predicted probability in our equation of Tunisia actually escaping from that not free category goes from about 30% to about 65%. Okay, this is based on some models we've run looking at the whole world. Institutions matter. Where power is vested matters. One of the reasons why a powerful legislature is so important is that the great enemy of free government over the last couple of decades in the world is not an overly strong insurgent civil society. It is not men in epaulettes, as much as military coup can still provide it still can provide something of a threat. It is not separatist movements. It is executives, oftentimes elected presidents. It is monarchs. It is overweening executive power. And the thing about legislatures is they can check overweening executives. Is Tunisia off to a particularly felicitous start, in part because it has taken decisions early on in its transition that look to be creating a system that is going to vest most political power at the national level in parliament and create a largely figurehead presidency? I would argue the answer is yes. If Libya, in fact, can follow Tunisia's path and establish a strong legislature and a relatively weak and constrained president, will that help Libya overcome the potentially baneful effects of its hydrocarbons dependence? It might. What about Egypt? Egypt seems on track now to be creating a relatively strong executive presidency that may actually hold decree powers. Now, no matter how open and democratic these elections were, and they were open and democratic in Egypt, they weren't perfect, but the elections for the presidency and for the parliament were, little monkey business aside, for the most part, open. And the guys who actually got the most votes won. This isn't Russia. That actually the votes were counted and everybody got to campaign, everybody got to run. Egypt actually underwent real democratization in these elections. But will the existence of a strong executive president who might enjoy decree power greatly undermine the prospects for democratization in Egypt? I would argue that the answer is yes, but the Egyptian story is just starting to be written right now. If the new Egyptian constitution vests exclusive authority to make laws in the parliament and denies the president the right to make law by decree, that, in the view of myself and many others who study this question, would be a terrific blow in favor of the eventual prospects for democratization in Egypt. So, institutions, political economy, issues like oil, levels of economic development, all these things are going to be in play as we discuss the cases we're going to be looking at tomorrow, both Tunisia and Russia, the larger Middle East and North Africa, and the post-communist region, and of course as we go on today and talk about democracy education and other issues, I think these issues will probably be in the background of our discussions as well. So thanks for your attention, and thank you so much for coming.
Welcome. In keeping with the theme of this conference, of having both scholars and practitioners, it's my pleasure to be moderating this panel. The panel consists of four speakers, and we have an hour and 30 minutes. And also, since this is a university and this is Berkeley, time for conversation and discussion. And so I'm going to request each speaker to speak for, by my math, that gives us an hour and 30 minutes. And if there are four speakers, everybody speaks for about 15 minutes. And I will try and hold flashcards, et cetera, reminding people that time is up. The panel is Democracy, Engagement, and Civic Participation. And what I will do is I'll introduce each speaker serially rather than introduce them all collectively. So I'll start with the first speaker, say a few words about them, and then let the speaker take over rather than introduce the whole panel. First, Mr. Robert Lagama, who is the president for a Council for Community of Democracies, right? Sounds suspiciously like CCC, okay. And who is also has had a distinguished career in the U.S. Information Agency and received the highest prize given by the U.S. Information Agency for public service, the Murrow Prize, if I recall correctly. So, Mr. Lagama, floor is yours, and you'll be speaking to us.
Thank you so much. I am overjoyed to be here in Berkeley, even though I had to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I first came to this campus in 1962 when I was starting college myself at the City College of New York, and hung out with students here and wished I had been coming here instead of going back to New York. So this is always the sweetest word in the academic world to me has always been Berkeley. So here I am. And it's also somewhat synonymous to me with democracy. I think there's so many good things that happen in this place that democracy has a good home here. I want to talk about what I call democracy education, the essential and often missing ingredient in democratic transitions, in democratic consolidations, and in established democracies like our own, where we take democratic values much too much for granted and don't do enough to perpetuate them by inculcating them in one way or another. I represent a small non-governmental organization in Washington, D.C. that was born in at the conclusion of the Warsaw Conference of June 2000, where Madeleine Albright, for the first time in history, called together more than 100 foreign ministers to talk about their common commitment to democracy. And at that conference, they drafted something signed by 106 countries called the Warsaw Declaration, which I think is an update of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and calls, underlines the imperative of all people all over the world having a right to a democratic form of government ultimately. What we do is we provide a civil society component to the community of democracies, which otherwise consists of governments. Governments working together on democratic values. We do that by organizing a network of 27 of us around the world who work for democracy promotion organizations. Some of them are human rights people in places like Russia or Singapore. Others are heads of institutions like the Westminster Foundation or the European Foundation for Democracy or the Institute for Democracy in South Africa. 27 of us, and we try to provide grassroots support for the concept of democracies working together. One of our most successful projects, the jewel in our crown, was Jeremy Kinsman's own Diplomat's Handbook endeavor, which we think is having an impact on changing the nature of contemporary diplomacy, having it catch up with events around the world that have led to democratization, increasing democratization, and putting diplomats from democratic countries on the side of democratic development. Another project that we've just launched yesterday is headed by Admiral Dennis Blair, former Director of National Intelligence of the United States. And Dennis has done a handbook called The Armed Forces in Democratic Transition, where he is about to publish a series of case studies taking, as his model, Jeremy Kinsman's project on diplomacy, where we look at transitions to democracy in places where the military once ruled, like Chile and Indonesia and Philippines and another a dozen places around the world. And we try to do what Jeremy did, and that is provide some guidance to policymakers and diplomats and military officers on what they can do to support democratic ideas among their counterparts and in civil society. Let me just begin by saying at the conclusion of the 1972 film that was set here in California, the candidate for Senate, played by Robert Redford, who wins an election, then utters the famous words, and what do we do next? Okay. It seems that that question was also posed in very dramatic fashion after the fall of the world, of the wall in Berlin, the end of apartheid, and the ouster of dictators following the Arab Awakening, and many other political transformations that have continued in what Huntington called the third wave of democratization. In monarchies, the answer is easy, and it's expressed in the expression, "The king is dead. Long live the king." No problem with transition there. But in most cases, the end of an old order leads to a vacuum. And the vacuum needs to be filled, and the dream of democracy has to take some form. And a constitution has to be articulated to enshrine the aspirations of people, to form a government that affords them the opportunity to live a better life. when the dust settles, institutions must be shaped to provide rule of law and representative government. Out of the ashes emerge, if it's done right, a free press, political parties, social, civil society, and if democracy is to stand a chance. And then there are those elections and how to conduct them and how to assure their fairness. What is needed then is a whole new set of rules. Jeremy pointed out that democracy is learned behavior. And people who have lived under an autocracy for all of their lives and all of the generations preceding them don't have those democratic habits. And they have to be learned. And sometimes that is very difficult. I want to make really three points, and that is, this is important, folks. This is essential. An informed citizenry, without an informed citizenry, there can be no democracy. Without a conscious effort to inform citizens about not only how to vote, but how to participate in the democratic process, there is no democracy. You may have one successful initial election, and then the next time around, hardly anybody goes to vote, or the numbers drop off precipitously, and there is very little else that goes along with that in terms of political participation. So when that dictator falls and new constitution is in place, and I've seen that happen in a number of places, including South Africa, which was my last diplomatic assignment at the time of Mandela, then begins a process of compromise, a national negotiation, which in turn is predicated on a tolerance for the views and interests of others, and a pact agreed upon by all parties, every one of which has to be prepared to make some sacrifices, to compromise, to tolerate views of others, to consider other alternatives. Under the dictatorship, absent were political parties, free expression, free press, right of assembly, free speech, representative government, rule of law. So the main options were either obedience to the regime or resistance, and very little in between. Democracy requires a whole new perspective, new habits, and they're sometimes very difficult to instill and come by. One point I would like to make is that the exercise of those rights has to be very carefully learned, and it's what we call education for democracy. And while ideally the entire population of a society in transition has to be immersed, should be immersed, in a month-long seminar. You know, let's bring them here to Berkeley and let's teach them how to develop these new habits. The nature of a transitional process makes that very difficult. Democracy education is a crash course in most cases. And it's done in a most adverse kind of circumstances with lots of distractions. And it's a traumatic experience, I think, for most people to have to go through that kind of change. Exhilarating sometimes, but also traumatic. Such was the case for South Africa, which you'll be hearing about from our friend Ed O'Brien, my neighbor here. And the problem we face in a country like ours is apathy and complacency and the failure of cultivating these democratic values. Democracy needs to be understood by the people that are affected by it and the people whose lives it changes and the people who really are the essence of it. And what I want to talk a minute about is the role of citizen participation during the transitional period, which is really critical in many countries around the world right now. There's a heavy concentration often on the first founding election, and we get those long lines in places like South Africa where 80 or 90% of the people are voting and they're excited. They are after what the word that has been used in the Arab Awakening more than anything else is a quest for dignity, human dignity. Not so much freedom and not so much liberty and not so much democracy, but the end of the humiliation that is imposed by an autocratic regime that makes decisions for people rather than allows them to make them themselves. Okay. I recall the fever pitch of political involvement in South Africa during the transition when apartheid ended. But then when the Mandela ANC government attempted to get citizens in the townships to end their boycott and pay their electric bills under the democratic regime, they found that old habits died hard. People just didn't want to pay for electricity. They were used to tapping into the public lines and not paying for it. And that was true of a lot of other behavior. I recall when I was in college, one of the great heroes of the African independence movement, Kwame Nkrumah, used to recite very often, "Give me first the political kingdom and all else will follow." And it turns out that it wasn't that simple. When the campaign promises of political parties during elections fail to deliver a better life, voters are frequently disillusioned with the newfound democracy, with the newfound freedom. They're asking questions like, where are the jobs? Where are the schools for our kids? Where's the housing that were promised? The expectations are always built up to a fever pitch during campaigns, and the delivery is never up to the promises. So the disillusionment sets in. This is especially true, we found, in Latin America, where we've had such a tremendous transformation from guys running countries with uniforms to democracies, and yet their tremendous disappointment, the lack of development of strong political parties, and the failure to deliver the promises. It's hard to persuade a people that have suffered repression and struggled and sacrifices that the hard part is yet to come. We saw that in South Africa. After all of those years of struggle, after all the suffering that occurred in South Africa, to have that government come to power and then to realize that the hard part was yet to come. They had to build a new political system, a new social system, a new economy, a task that takes a generation or more. And they're not there yet. Yeah. Well, that's why we think that democracy and civil society requires a heavy investment in encouraging citizen participation at every level, and starting with the schools. In the long term, it's the schools that will make the difference and will develop a commitment to democracy, but not the way we did it when I was in school, not the civics courses that I took. This has to be done with passion and imagination. It has to be not done as a separate subject, but it has to be integrated into history, into geography, into social studies. It has to be done with an eye to involvement in the community and not just sitting around listening in the classroom. It cannot be done by memorizing the names of the counties in Michigan, as my friend recounted to me he had imposed on him when he studied civics in high school. Let me just give a couple of examples of how I think this works in a couple of places. In Taiwan, the teacher training college in Taipei did an experiment in high schools. They involved students in environmental projects They had them study, for example, the elimination of a wetlands and the replacement of that wetlands near their school with a housing project. And they had them recommend to the city authorities whether this was a good idea or not. That was one of many projects of that kind. This is a good example, I think, of what kinds of things can be done. In South Africa, at the end of apartheid, it was a laboratory for the world. You know, how are they going to do this? When we gained our independence and had to write a constitution, we looked around for models. And where did the founding fathers of the United States look? They looked to ancient Greece and Rome, because there weren't too many models of democracy around in those days. The South Africans looked to Australia, they looked to Canada, they looked to the United States, they looked to Eastern Europe, they looked to Western Europe. They had lots of models. They actually sent exploratory delegations around the world to look at how best to do broadcasting. You know, should we do it like the BBC or the Americans? Or they decided the Australian model was best for them. And they adapted that. They didn't just buy it whole hog. They designed all of their institutions with their own needs in mind. And that was interesting. I did a conference for African educators in South Africa after the transition. And we brought together a group of civil society people to say, help us do this. And they said, we don't want these guys to sit in a classroom. People came from 25 African countries, and instead of talking at them, we took them to Soweto, we showed them what civil society organizations were doing, we took them to the Constitutional Court and talked about how that was structured, we took them to see street theater in the townships, they came away with a sense that you know, there was something very important happening here. That it was, there was a dynamic situation that was engaging the entire society, and we hope they took some of those lessons back home and used them. And I think I'll try to wind up very quickly. What we have done, and which we distributed here, is we produced what we call a, very pretentiously, a global strategic plan. We brought together experts from about 20 countries, and we said, what is needed at the macro level, at the international, at the global level, to get governments to take actions that will reinforce democracy in countries around the world, in their own countries and in other people's countries? And we've set out this global strategic plan, and it has been adopted by the Community of Democracies as its program. The government of Mongolia, the chair of the Community of Democracies, has made it its priority. Ban Ki-moon, the other day, has said this is going to be the theme of International Democracy Day on Monday. It will be celebrated on Monday. Actually, it's Saturday, but it will be marked on Monday. I will be going there for a ceremony that will involve all of the UN missions. And we're hoping to generate some support for Mongolia's plan to hold a conference of policymakers in New Delhi in January that will lead to concrete reforms in a number of countries. We recently got a grant from the United Nations Democracy Fund to run a project that will start off with some pilot programs in places like Ghana or Nepal or Tunisia. We're still working on that. And we're preparing a manual of best practices from around the world of what countries are doing effectively to advance democracy education in their countries. So we're trying to operate at this policy level, and basically we're asking countries to do what Samuel Gompers asked industry to do. What do you people really want? We want more. We want more resources, we want a higher priority given to this subject, and we want to see action taken in the next couple of years to reflect the fact that this is the glue that holds democracies together, especially in new and fragile democracies, but even in our country.
Thank you. Sorry, I can't see. Our next speaker is Ms. Red O'Brien, founder of Street Law, which I think is amazing work, bringing law to the non-lawyer. And he's done path-breaking work in South Africa. And it's a real pleasure to have him here, because I'd like to have some legal knowledge as well. You never know when it comes in handy. So, Mr. O'Brien, thank you.
Okay. I'll give you a little bit of background of who I am. I started off as a high school social studies teacher in Baltimore, Maryland. And I'd had 1 year of law school when I started teaching, so I used law in my classes. And all of a sudden, there was a lot of interest. What happens if I'm stopped by the police? What happens in this situation? And all of a sudden, they weren't just falling asleep like they were in my other social studies classes. They were actually getting quite lively. So I went back to Georgetown Law School and finished up. And in finishing up, I sat in a class where a professor said, would anybody like to get involved in a program where law students would go out and teach in the high schools? And I said, well, I did this as a high school teacher. Why not? I'll do it as a law student as well. And I sort of raised my hand, and I kept that hand up for the next 40 years because we created an organization called Street Law, Inc. We took this around the United States. We took it to about 40 different countries, and the concept has become, I'm happy to say, kind of accepted around the world as meaning law in your everyday life on the street, law you need to learn, democracy education. And over the years, we expanded it from just law to democracy and human rights, because you really need all three. I've written some articles on this that all three go together. The essence of the program is two things. One, it's practical and relevant to everyday life. And two, it's highly participatory and interactive. So I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, to wake up a little bit after lunch and do a very short exercise with me. Everybody will need to stand up, and all the people on the end here need to have a pen or find a pen. This is called the pencil game. Everybody has to hold up a pen. If everybody would just stand up, the entire group, because you're teams.
Well, maybe I try this.
You're a team if you're across. You can be seated too. You don't have to be stand to be a team, but as long as you're in a line. So we have probably about 10 or 11 teams. Now, over on the end is a person with a pen. Hold the pen up, everybody on the end of every row. Very good. We're doing very well so far. Now, I want you to start the game. Why aren't you doing something?
Put the pen away.
That would be one possibility. Put the pen away. All right. You need to know something more, I guess, to play the game. All right. Pass the pen into the right hand of the person next to you, all the way across, and then back. Okay, go. No, hold on. Wait a minute. You got to push it to your left hand when it gets across the middle. It switches to the left hand when you get across the middle. So pass it back to where we started. You're just not doing the game right.
We're just not doing the game right.
Okay, start the game again, going across. Okay, this group didn't get it back. All right, this group here, this is the third, team three, wins because they have more men in their team than any other team. So they're the winners of that particular game. Now, Jeremy, you don't know this, but Jeremy is my cousin. And that's another reason why he won that game. And then, now, does anyone have a dollar? Yeah. Anyone give me a dollar? Jeremy, he's my cousin, he's going to give me a dollar.
Not $20.
Well, that'll be all right.
If I give you a dollar, will there
be? I got $5.
All right, well, you'll get it back, I promise. Thank you, Jeremy. That's another reason his team won the game. All right, you can sit down now. Thank you very much.
So this
game has been played in probably 50 different countries, as well as all across the United States. It's a game that's part of the street law program. I teach now a law and ethics course at the University of District of Columbia, combining street law with some ethics materials, and they do this game too, and they love it just as much. So, but what does it illustrate? Who can tell me what it illustrates?
Fairness.
Somebody said corruption. Procedural fairness. What is fair in a game or in society or in government? What is fair? What else does it illustrate? What did I do? As you
lack of communication.
Communication must be good for society to run well. So the communication is key.
The rules can't change.
I'm sorry, sir?
Ability to follow orders.
It's a dictatorship, for one thing. I'm the dictator. Nobody got any input into this game or any decision-making at all. This was definitely illustrates a dictatorship and what could happen in a dictatorship. I also changed the rules in the middle of the game. That's something you shouldn't do. And we actually have a phrase in law called ex post facto laws, as many of you know, I'm sure, where you pass a law and then have it apply to something that's already taken place. So these are illustrations that illustrated concepts that we can do through a very simple game that takes no more than five or ten minutes. Now, in 1980, we had been doing street law across the United States, and that meant we got law schools to send law students out at 70 law schools in the United States, including Berkeley, including University of San Francisco, which has been the center of the street law program out here. And this whole concept of law students going out and teaching has been very popular. But it's not the only way to do it. In fact, you must do it with teachers. If you're going to have democracy education the way Bob says that you must have it, you need to do it with teachers. You need to have teacher training. You're going to have law students come in and help them, lawyers come in and help them, human rights people can help them, whoever can come in and help, but you need to have teachers trained. But the law school model is a good one. We took it to South Africa in 1985. I was brought over by Bob's old organization, the U.S. Information Agency, and I toured South Africa for about a month. I did workshops all around South Africa, and there was great reception, and in particular, down in Durban, South Africa, David McCoy Mason, who was the dean of the law school in those days, some of you may have met David. David is one of the biggest proponents of democracy education, is the biggest, I would say, in the world. He's been, I think, to over 100 countries now, actually, helping them set up programs. And he's retired as dean, so he can do that. And he does it very well. So I met up with him, and he took the American Street Law book, we have a high school textbook, and he changed it for South Africa. He produced five pamphlets that were corresponded to five chapters in the American Street Law book. And the American Street Law book is all activities like this pencil game, not all activities, but many activities like this pension game. Lots of case studies, lots of role plays, mock trials are a key thing. We created the mock trial competition in Washington, D.C., and that spread all around the country and also to a number of other countries as well. But when I went to South Africa, we ran into some problems. There were some challenges in South Africa. And one of the challenges is illustrated by a meeting that David McCoy Mason had with a principal of a Black Zulu high school in what was then called Zululand, is now called KwaZulu-Natal. And he told the principal about this idea of teaching law to his students and teaching them their rights. And this principal looked at him and said, "Why do you teach our children to jump up and bite us in the throat?" So he had that kind of problem with some people. Weren't quite open to it. But others were, fortunately. I had a problem like that in South Africa, too. I went to a meeting in a men's club in Port Elizabeth, and on the coast in South Africa. And meeting me was a man I was told was the brother of the Minister of Law. Well, this is around 1987. There had just been emergency orders issued by the Minister of Law to arrest many, many people and to stop demonstrations, etc. So I was meeting his brother, and my role was supposed to be to sell him on the street law program. So I was a bit nervous about what was going to happen when I met this Afrikaner. The name was Vlak, if any of you know South Africa. The minister was named Vlak. So I told Mr. Vlak what street law was all about, and he kept listening very intently. And then he looked at me and he said, "I like this street law. We will teach them to obey the law." That wasn't exactly what we had in mind, but I left quickly because I didn't want to just disavow him of that idea. Whatever. Bob mentioned this idea of what do you do after the election. And in South Africa, a group of people came together and said, we need to have a training program for people in what is democracy besides elections. And so they created, we were a team, our Street Law Inc. people and the South Africa people, including David McCoy and Mason, created a book called Democracy for All. And this, I think, is about as good as I've seen of a book to simplify democracy and have a lot of interesting exercises in it. Basically, to tell you what's in it, the chapters are, what is democracy? How government works in a democracy? Checking the abuse of power? Human rights in democracy? Elections? Citizen participation, perhaps one of the most important things. In our programs, we not only have students participate in class, like a pencil game or some other role play or activity, we also have them go out into the community, go out and see what's really going on in their society, get them to volunteer, community service, advocacy programs where young people get together and try to bring about change in their community. This is a big part of the citizens' participation part of this book and of our programs. The last thing I want to mention really is some work we've done in Mongolia. Mongolia has been mentioned already as sort of a model for a country moving towards democracy. And we found the same thing when we went there to teach. They were so open to the idea. They took the Democracy for All book and they put all different examples in there that were Mongolian-based examples, and they translated it into Mongolian, and they published it, and it's still being used in the schools today in Mongolia. Some of you may have gotten a handout called the Snow Leopard. The people get a white page handout called the Snow Leopard. It may not have gotten to everybody, and we have copies we can give people later, but this is from the Mongolian curriculum that they produced. And just to give you an example of what they do in Mongolia to try to make it relevant to Mongolian kids is they have this example that kind of goes like this, a case study. We use a lot of case studies. Mungum is a herdsman and lives in Kurd Amig, I can't pronounce that. Mungan's family has many cows, goats, and sheep. One night, Mungan hears noise from the dog and animals outside. He takes his gun and goes out from the gear. Outside, he sees dead animals and a leopard, which is still eating his sheep. Mungan shoots the leopard. Later, the police visit Mungan and tell him that he must pay a fine for killing the snow leopard, which is an endangered species. He does not pay, as he says he has the right to protect his property. Mungan must go to court to settle this dispute. So what do we teach through this? We have a discussion of these two competing values, endangered species and property rights, and which should really overturn the other. Which should be more important? The role of courts comes in here. Oh, we got copies are coming out. Good. The role of courts in making these decisions and helping the society, hopefully in a helpful way. They're not corrupt, of course. They balance the different interests and decide what's most important at this stage of the society and what to do in regard to it. So the students were very interested in this, and this is just an example of how you take the broader concepts of law and justice, human rights, environmental issues, and build them into local problems. Because we don't believe you just take a curriculum. We didn't take the American Street Law book and say, go teach this American Street Law book in Albania and in Russia, China, all these, we've been in many of these countries. We said, here's an American Street Law book. Some of this may be useful to you, some may not. The techniques are useful, though. It's all about the methods. Obviously, you need content, important, relevant content, practical content. But what you really need are interactive methods. You really need these sort of case studies and debates, mock trials and role plays. Small group work is very important to get kids all talking, because when you get everybody in a small group, everybody participates. In a big group, you don't get everybody to participate. So we did in the pencil game get everybody to participate, if you notice. So you can do it through things like that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
ask.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Mr. Gary Sraga, who has taught for the Political Science Department, has worked as a consultant for Native American tribes, other NGOs, and most importantly, I guess, has been a chief strategist for the Democrats in California for many, many years. And so he's going to tell us how you educate the citizenry to take part in elections or vote the right way.
Just to vote for us.
Just to vote for us.
If you're not going to vote for us, we don't encourage you to vote, trust me. In fact, dirty little secret some of you may know is that part of any good campaign, certainly the Obama campaign, is to depress the vote. Seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to talk, this is off subject, I realize. But look, you got to. How many of you were around in 1986 and when Alan Cranston beat Ed Schauer? Are there people in this room who remember that? Okay, so I ran Alan Cranston's campaign. When you have this is a little aside. So when you have an unpopular incumbent, which is what the president is, running for re-election, he starts off the election with all the votes he's going to get. If you notice, the polls don't move very much because most voters have decided they either want the president re-elected or they don't want the president re-elected. So the battle, you will discover if you just follow this over the next 2 months, is only to a very limited extent over persuading undecided voters to vote for your candidate as opposed to the opponent, because there aren't that many undecided voters. A lot of what goes on in these campaigns will be an effort to discourage turnout by the opposition. Obama's biggest concern is that his base come out, and Romney's got the same problem. But that's an aside. It'll be a great day when most countries in the world have to deal with that dynamic.
Australia.
Yes. But, you know, if you don't have elections, you don't worry about that. You just kill the opponent. Which we don't do here, generally speaking. So, as you heard, look, I've run 5 campaigns for statewide office in California, 3 for governor, 2 for U.S. Senate. I ran the California Legislative Democrats campaigns in the Assembly for a bunch of years. I've run school bond campaigns. But nonetheless, I am somewhat normal. I'm a lawyer. I'm the managing partner of the Los Angeles office of one of the largest firms in the world. We have 1,400 lawyers. I know that's a scary thought. In 43 countries and 60 offices. We have offices in a lot of the Middle East and Africa. So I live with some of these issues just about every day. I taught undergraduate political science. I've taught undergraduate political science as an adjunct I'm in my 13th year. And I teach one course a semester. My first eight semesters, were right here at the University of California at Berkeley, where every Thursday at 2 o'clock, interestingly enough, I had to be on campus. Remember, I live in Los Angeles. And the school does not reimburse for transportation. But for the last 9 years, I've taught at USC, and I will be barreling out of here as soon as this panel's over because my class is at 7 o'clock tonight at USC. So, you know, I thought, well, Alan and I have known each other for a long time, and Jeremy and Alan and I bonded over Indian food in Vancouver back in March after a conference. And I thought, well, what could I bring to the table here that other people aren't going to bring, other than maybe a lot of cynicism? I have had very little experience with regime change, although I will tell you that by quirk of fate, I happened to be in Tiananmen Square the day before and the day after martial law was declared, having been invited by the People's Republic to speak on American politics to Chinese college students, and they forgot to cancel the trip. So my wife and I literally got there and marched down Chang'an Avenue from the Jingling, the Beijing-Toronto, and we were in the middle of Tiananmen Square. Twice, day before, day after. Day after, there were helicopter gunships overhead. I thought they wouldn't shoot me. I don't look Chinese. And they didn't. That's a bizarre thought, but nonetheless it worked. I'm still here. So in thinking about what I would want to share, some observations or some thoughts, you're free to accept or reject. What I tell my students when I teach this stuff is, look, everything we're talking about comes down to one five-letter word. This whole discussion comes down to one five-letter word. It starts with a P. It's power. Politics is about power. It's who gets to run things, who gets to rule things. You're either running things or you're out. That's it. It's that simple. And everything else is execution. I don't mean that literally. It's how you get stuff done. Okay? We're talking about power. Who runs a country? Who runs a city? Who runs a state? And this is not a nice game. It's a tough game. I've played it for a lot of years. I personally am a very nice person. You'll have to stipulate that. But let me tell you, this is hard-knuckled stuff. It is playing for keeps. This isn't a joke. It's very serious, and the stakes are very high. And the players who play it that way. So if this is a discussion about power, the question is, how have we established in the United States of America a system that has managed, with one notable exception, for us to share power and to shift power peacefully? To me, that is the significance of the United States of America. We have lasted for a couple centuries, and with the exception of a stretch in the 1860s where tens of thousands of Americans killed each other, let's just note that for the record, because there's a lot of mythology about what America is all about, we have managed to run this country peacefully for a couple of centuries. And, you know, I view this as, I know, kind of silly, but I thought, okay, what's democracy? Democracy is lamb stew. And there's only one ingredient that has to be in lamb stew if you're going to call it lamb stew, and that's lamb. Everything else can be local ingredients, local herbs, local spices, local vegetables. And so I wanted to, I was thinking, well, what's the lamb in lamb stew? And to me, the fundamental ingredient in the American political system, and I believe this very strongly, is that we have an ethos, we have a belief that one person equals one vote. It used to be every man gets a vote. We're now gender neutral. One person, one vote. Every person in this country, according to that ethos, has the right to have an equal say in the formulation of public policy. Now, you can agree or disagree with that, but to me, that's the lamb and the lamb stew. That's the one thing you have to have if you're going to have a democracy, is a fundamental belief that every citizen of that society has an equal say in the formulation of public policy. Now, if that's true, let's note for the record that we've done a pretty bad job. Okay? We believe that. I love America. I think we have the best system in the world. But then you have to say, okay, how have we defined, you know, I'm going to be a lawyer for a second, what's the definition of a person? Well, a person who has a vote in America was originally what? A white male who owned property. You were not a person who had a vote if you were female until 1920. You were not a person who had a vote in this country if you were under 21 until 1972, and then we lowered the voting age to 18. And for about 100 years, notwithstanding what the Constitution said and what the law said, you really were not a person who had a vote if you were African American. So I think it's important, if we're going to talk about democratization of the world, and I certainly think that we've heard that's the trend. Occasionally it's two steps forward and one step back, and certainly it's our goal, and I think we want that to be what the world becomes. I think we need to realize that what democracy is all about is that everybody gets theoretically an equal say in the formulation of policy. And in order to do that, you have to have certain mechanisms. You have to have a constitution that embodies the broad objectives and the vision of what that society is. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, if you look at the jurisprudence, is one of the most important, whatever it is, 12 words in this country. Equal Protection Clause has been the basis for opening up the political process. You have to have a constitution. You have to have an independent judiciary that can overturn stupid decisions by other branches. You have to have separation of powers. There are certain very basic things that you have to have if you're going to have something that we would label a democracy. But fundamentally, democracy only works from the ground up. It only works if the people who are the intended participants in the process believe in the democracy, believe in that ethos. Believe that you can balance, and this is again the beauty of the American system, you can balance the rights of the majority and the rights of the minority. Should the minority tyrannize the majority? No, but we have it going on right now in Washington, D.C. with the House of Representatives. You know, I mean, the majority has certain rights, can't trounce the minority, but on the other hand, the minority is not expected to be able to hold the majority hostage. There's a balance between public interests and private interests. And that's a very careful balance that we've established in this country. What is the role of an elected representative? I mean, there've been a lot of treatises written about whether your job as an elected official in a democracy is to do what you think is right or what your voters, the people who elected you, expected you to do. There are an enormous number of tensions that I'm trying to whip through here in about 15 minutes that underlie what we call American democracy and underlie what we think we're selling to the rest of the world. And those, to me, are the lamb. Those are the core concepts. And and how those are flavored in other countries, I think, you know, we have no control over, shouldn't expect to have control over, and it's important that the people in those countries be able to flavor that. I also want to say, I think, that we need to not be too self-congratulatory. Because again, I run campaigns in the real world in this country. I have sat through more focus groups than any of you would wish, because when you sit through focus groups, as some of you know, you consume large quantities of M&Ms behind a one-way mirror, and I'm a type 2 diabetic, so that's not good. But I have literally sat through hundreds of focus groups, and I have conducted a lot of polls, and I've given a lot of speeches in other countries and on American democracy, and I've done all that stuff. And look, right now in the United States, two-thirds of the electorate think that the country's headed in the wrong direction. That is a very important number for everybody to recognize. That number has existed for quite a while. It's existed probably since about 11 years ago yesterday, or 2 days ago, since 9/11. Americans are unhappy. There is a very strong sense in America that the political system is broken. And one of the fundamental tenets of this country is competition. We believe competition is very important in the economic marketplace. It is a great tenet of the country. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you think that competition is good. But I would submit to you that our political system in this country has been in the hands of a duopoly for many, many years, that there are absolute barriers to entry into the political marketplace, that there are no new voices in the political dialogue. As some people who asked me to come here today know, I spent from September of last year till January of this year very quietly traveling the country, racked up a hell of a lot of miles on United, because it was my job to talk to people who might want to run for president of the United States on the Americans Elect ballot. For those of you who know what Americans Elect is, it's an organization that was funded significantly by a guy named Peter Ackerman, who's associated with the Fletcher School at Tufts and has spent a lot of time and effort on regime change to introduce a third voice into the political dialogue, because there is a real thirst on the part of voters in America for more choices. Now, you can come back at me on that if you want, but I'm quite convinced from the research I've done, Americans are very dissatisfied with the choices that are being served up by the Democrats and the Republicans. If you know anybody who's enthused about the Obama Romney race, please let me know. I'd like to give them a call. And I will tell you that I talk to people you've read about and you know by name in the paper. I signed a confidentiality agreement, and I can't tell you who they are, but they're senators, former senators, governors, former governors, mayors, corporate executives, and labor leaders. The only name that leaked out was Mike Bloomberg, but all the other names remain secret. And I will tell you, and I would testify to this under oath, that every one of those people, every one of those potential presidents of the United States, said to me in a meeting where it was just me and that person, or maybe there were three or four of us in the room, that the American political system is broken. They all believe that. Most of them did not believe that Americans Elect was a viable solution, and it turned out Americans Elect at the end of the day did not get on the ballot for a whole set of reasons. That's a separate discussion. And they also, none of them were courageous enough to take on their party, which I don't consider a flaw. That's reality. So I think when we talk about selling American democracy to the rest of the world, one of the things we have to be thinking about is we still have some work to do here in the United States. The process right now is not in great shape. I don't think we're about to collapse. I don't think there's going to be a revolution. You know, if it was China, we might have a cultural revolution and send everybody in Washington out into the fields, but we don't do that. And I think we need to not be too self-congratulatory. On the other hand, there is the lamb and the lamb stew, and if we identify the important elements that make America what it is and have made our system work for most of these 200-plus years, then I think we have something to offer the rest of the world. So thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Qureshi.
Thank you, Pradeep. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm indeed honored to be in this great university with all you lovely people I've been hearing about. As Pradeep mentioned, we have a very large voter base. 780 million is the number. for the next general election, which is more than all 50 countries of Europe put together, all 46 of North and South America put together, 55 of Africa put together, an entire Commonwealth. But we have been conducting these elections very successfully for 62 years, ever since we started using the electronic voting machines. By lunchtime, the nation knows the results.
Wow.
And not once have we delayed the election by a day. Not once the legitimacy of the government has been questioned. People have lost by one vote and still they have accepted the verdict with folded hands. Nobody questioned. So the credibility has been established because of the strength of the institution of Election Commission, which the framers of the Constitution very widely made fiercely independent. It's a three-member commission now. It used to be a single member with so much of power. Probably the Indian Election Commission is the most powerful commission in the world, because once we announce the elections, almost virtually the entire government comes under us. We can transfer the chief secretary, the police chief, or anybody. Government cannot take any decision because this will may amount to seducing the voters and using unfair incumbency advantage. So with for all this, we have just a three-member commission from 1993. The talking of the size, we used about 1.2 electronic voting machines. 11 million people are seconded to the commission to conduct the election. That's for the last election. This time it will be a little more. Each one of them has a very specific role. Zero tolerance is what we allow them, which means they have to be trained to give us a mistake-free election anywhere. Because any mistake in the election will lead to the public the hue and cry. The legitimacy will be questioned. It may lead to ordering of the repoll, and we cannot afford to do that. India is probably one of the most diverse countries in the world. All the major religions of the world we have 6,000 castes. We have 18 official languages. We 6,000 dialects, besides many thousand local variation. And since it's a land of diversities and minorities, every community is a minority somewhere or the other, linguistic minorities, ethnic, cultural, and everybody's interest has to be protected. Everybody must have faith in the system. There are adequate laws protecting the status of all minority, and there is prohibition on the use of religion, caste, community, creed, or language to woo the voters, because it will vitiate the fairness of the election. Religious places cannot be used. But for the really weaker sections of society, which whom we call scheduled castes and scheduled tribes, what was formerly known as untouchables, are now there is a schedule in the constitution listing them. That's why they're called scheduled castes and scheduled tribes. For them, there is a reservation about 15% for scheduled castes and 7.5% for scheduled tribes, so that they are adequately represented. There has been a demand that there should be the 30% reservation for women in parliament, but that bill has been pending for a long time. There is a lot of opposition. But interestingly, at the local level election, the municipal election and the rural election, the 33% reservation was introduced 20 years ago, and the experiment was very successful. And 3 years ago, 2 years ago, this has been increased to 50%, and women are participating. Initially, of course, women were illiterate, or their husbands were dominating. They were proxy, the heads of the elected bodies. But gradually, women started coming to their own. Our efforts are to ensure that every community and every cultural sensitivity is looked after. For instance, there are many communities where women observe a veil, as you know, they wear a veil. for them. We have separate queues. We have separate polling stations in many places. We also have a women officer posted in every polling station. And even on the electoral roll, we introduced photographs on electoral rolls only 5-7 years ago. There, some women in Tamil Nadu protested that their photo on the electoral roll can be misused because photos can be morphed. It went up to the court and we came up with a compromise formula that the printed roll must have a photograph. It is, after all, it's a postage stamp size picture. But soft copy of the electoral roll will not carry a woman's photograph so that it cannot be misused. So we try to take care of every sensibility. For the disabled, every polling station, 1 million polling station, must have a ramp. Every single electronic voting machine EVM has braille facility, and companion is allowed for the infirm and the weak. For the illiterate, we use symbols along with the name of the candidate so that it's easy for them to identify. And for the minorities, the electoral roll has to be, besides the national language, Hindi or English, has to be in the local, the minority language also. Or the ballot paper also is a bilingual to take care of the minorities. Then recently, to make it really inclusive, because that was the title of the overall work seminar, came up with what is considered a very interesting innovation. We used to receive a representation from transgenders, that their gender is not known, whether they are male or female, when the voter, the election man goes to enroll them and find it very confusing where to list the person. So we introduce another gender, other gender, male, female, or other. Now 1 million people are now known as gender O, and this has been followed by the census people also. 1 million people got enfranchised by a very simple measure that we took. Now the security, you know, these minorities and the weaker sections and the downtrodden have to feel secure to be able to come and participate in the election. We are always innovating, we are always learning. We introduced a system of vulnerability mapping of every polling booth. Who are the criminals who are likely to intimidate the voters? Which are the upper castes which dominate and do not allow the voters to come out and vote? Because in many cases, low turnout is the vested interest of the dominant parties, because their voters will come out in any case. And if there is a law and order situation created, if there are bullets flying around, people are scared. Women are the first victim of any violence. So they are scared to come out. So we have to ensure that there is peace, the law and order. So we started doing vulnerability mapping. Who are the criminals? What is their background? Who are the people who are likely to be threatened by them? And then we take preventive action under various laws. And in the last general election, about 370,000 such people were identified, and action was taken, including preventive arrest under the law. They can go on bail or bond for good behavior so that they do not misbehave. We also introduce a video trail of criminal candidates, because we have been demanding the government that they should bring a law to debar people with a criminal antecedent from contesting election. But till that happens, because there is a lot of resistance, we decided that such people will be trailed by a video camera 24 hours. They keep looking over their shoulder, and when they realize that everything is being recorded, they behave. Which is why we have been able to conduct very peaceful elections recently. We also provide a central armed police force. Every state demands, every party in every state demands that we bring forces from outside, because they don't trust the local police, they don't trust the local officials. So we have to bring observers from outside, central police from outside. And we also conduct election in many phases. In UP, for instance, 3 months ago, we conducted election in 7 phases. Same force is multiplied, you know, taken from one phase to the other. And lots of measures that we have taken. But one of the challenges that we had was participation. I have a little bit of a communication background. In fact, my PhD is in social marketing, which incidentally is the first PhD in social marketing in the world, because it was not an academic subject. In fact, it was a technique of communication followed by USAID across the world. Richard Manoff of Washington, D.C. was my guru, and he wrote the first book on that, social marketing. Just as you can sell soap, you should be able to sell an idea. So following all the marketing principles, you communicate, it works wonders. I was a believer in a strong communication, and sir, in your speech when you mentioned without informed citizenry, there is no democracy. So that was my belief. I first joined as election commissioner. It's a 6-year term, and the senior most becomes the chief. So I was the chief election commissioner for 2 years. Very first week, I suggested that we should focus on voter education, because our turnout, average turnout, has been about 60% in parliament. But as you go lower down, participation increases. It was dismissed by the then chief at that time. Do it in your time. But it was quite hurtful. What is my time? I was an equal member, I had an equal vote, that was my time as well. Every action of the election commission, I was equally participant. But just as well, I got my time after 4 years. And the first thing I did was to set up a voter education division. We started, got professional agencies to conduct a knowledge, attitude, behavior and practice survey. Using social marketing techniques, and on that basis we wanted to know what is the reason for voter apathy, that the word Ed also used. Why are voters indifferent to election process? Particularly urban apathy is the issue. Only 25%, 30%, 35% people turn out and vote. And these are the guys who sit in their drawing rooms and criticize the government. They have no business to comment on the government in whose formation they have not participated. And not only they do not vote, it is almost a fashion statement not to vote. Oh, all politicians are thieves. We don't want to vote. I've never voted in my life. So we thought that instead of a fashion statement, this needs to be converted into a statement of shame and embarrassment. So we launched a campaign, very interesting campaign in Delhi, for instance, called the Pappu campaign. Pappu is a very common pet name in India, very endearing, of a very simple guy, and we sometimes use contemptuously. So there was a film song, Hindi film song, Pappu Cannot Dance Sala. Now Pappu is a smart guy in that film, in that song, who does everything, multi-talented fellow, but he has only one flaw, he cannot dance. So we created a parody on that. Our Pappu can do everything including dance, his flaw is he doesn't vote. So we on that we developed songs, and it was so effective that at the end of the poll in the election in Delhi, everybody who had not voted was hiding his face, because we did name and shaming through that. And all those who had voted for the first time, they were showing their finger that it has to be marked. Look, I'm not a Pappu, I voted. It was wonders for us. You know, learning from this kind of example, we did the loss of communication program. We converted into a people's movement. We were accused of murdering the festival of democracy that it used to be by imposing a very tight rules and regulation. Of course, there is a tight control on the campaigning, canvassing. It has to be noise-free. You can't deface the walls. You cannot put up posters. You have to stop your loudspeaker at a particular time. But then we brought in festival through people's participation. In UP, for instance, because of our after we created this voter division, participation division, 11 elections were conducted, 11 states, and every one of them recorded highest turnout in history. In the last election in UP 3 months ago, there was 30% increase in turnout of voters and 45% increase in turnout of women voters. In all these 11 states, women outvoted men, so which also was a very significant thing, because we used women, local icons, singers, actors, as brand ambassadors, as icon. Their appeal, all the efforts helped us to help to achieve great participation. You know, there used to be a demand there should be compulsory voting. Very top leaders of the country, whom I would not name, who used to demand that there should be compulsory voting, and they used to quote Australia. Well, my answer was instantly that compulsion and democracy don't go together. Your right to vote includes your right not to vote. And I thought the other alternative was voter education, persuading them, telling them and facilitating them. And it worked. And also it's important for us to understand the logic why we oppose compulsory voting, because if there is a law and if you do not vote, you are violating the law, there has to be a punishment. And even if it is 1 cent fine imposed on you, you have to follow due process of law, which means court cases have to be filed against you. Now, 300 million people who had not voted in the last general election would mean there will be 300 million court cases added after every election. It's impossible to follow. I asked my Australian counterpart how the compulsory voting in Australia is working. He said that they are really very troubled by this, and in fact they are having second thought. Just to recover $1 or $5 of fine, they have to incur $2,000 of expenditure and prolonged litigation, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years. So it is, and after all that, the turnout is 90%. Here we have brought turnout to 80, 85, 90%. Through persuasion, through voter education. So I do strongly believe that voter power, without participation, democracy cannot be successful. But let me also make it clear that when we talk of participation, it's not just turnout on the day of voting. It's also they have to get enrolled. We found the youth, particularly in 18 to 20 age bracket, were not getting enrolled. So we came up with a very innovative scheme. I was addressing a conference like this in Odisha. And somebody from the audience got up and said that 18 is an age to celebrate. He said, sounds like a good idea, a good statement. Let's think of celebrating. Within a week, we came up with what is probably the biggest youth empowerment program of the world. We decided that normally electoral rolls are published in April, May, June, November, and the qualifying date for new voters is 1st of January. We decided that if we start looking for them in advance, this happened in the end of September, we still had 3 months for 1st of January. We started looking for 18-year-olds who will be 18 on 1st of January, and we decided that in the whole country, 5th of January, across the country, we'll issue the new electoral roll. And on 25th January, which is our Founders Day, we'll have 800,000 functions across the country at every booth level, where these new voters will be given their voter ID card. It was such a success. I declared it as National Voters Day. Very innocently, although I have been a civil servant, I should have known that a national day can only be declared by the government. But after joining the Election Commission, we feel so independent that we forget all about the rules of bureaucracy. I had written a letter to the Cabinet Secretary mentioning that we are going to observe 25th January as National Voters Day, and will you ask all ministries and states to give us cooperation. 2 months later, just a week before this D-Day, I received an inquiry from the Cabinet Secretary. Two questions. One, whether it will be a national holiday, or two, how much money will be involved. Fortunately, our answers were very palatable. One, we don't need a holiday, and secondly, we don't need a single dollar. Why? How can we do 800,000 functions across the country without a single dollar? Because voter registration is a normal activity anyway. Instead of doing it sporadically, haphazardly, we were just doing it in a planned manner. And very happily, the cabinet declared it as a national day for all time. And the very first National Voter Day, 18 million people got their voter card in one function, 800,000 simultaneous function. 8 months ago, the second National Voter Day, it went up to 38 million. And the kind of participation, you know, for whether it is registration, whether it is for turnout, then also we do the voter education for the ethical voting, that they should not take any bribe for voting. All these measures work so beautifully. In one district, 115 kilometer long human chain was formed. In one place, the entire stadium was decorated with the flowers and colors, you know, the thing called Rangoli, which is a very festive thing that we do. It became a people's participation, people's program, and all these efforts have shown us dividends, have they worked wonders for us, and have now been institutionalized. And many countries who had participated in the National Voter Day function, 35 countries of the world, including the chief from the U.S. Election Commission, they came, and many of them found these, some of these ideas to be very replicable. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Just a little aside. Elections in India are a national holiday, so the day there's an election, everything is closed. But so you know that helps turn out, I guess.
Except the polls.
Yes, and in local turnout is often over 80%. Just by itself, you don't need to do anything. So with that, floor is open. Questions, comments for whomsoever. Yes, sir.
Well, as an Australian citizen here.
Yes.
We're focused on transitions, and I love your program, and positive inducements are much better than negative sanctions, and I, you know, engendering enthusiasm is a wonderful idea. But the time taken would be the matter of concern in my mind. Now, you pass legislation that there's a penalty, and the penalty is
not just the money. The penalty is the hassle you go through as a voter to have to justify and so on. So it's a real strong deterrent. So if you want to get a high voter turnout in a post-transition situation or in a transition and then immediately following, it seems to me the legislation requiring voting and having a penalty for it will accomplish that much more quickly.
Yes, you know, we were very clear that the compulsion is not going to work because it will be impractical. We won't be able to enforce it. As it is, after 60 years of independence, we have only about 16 million court cases pending. On that, 300 million will be added by after every election by us. So we don't have the court, we don't have to enforce. But when the voter education is working so successfully, as I said, highest ever turnout, and you see 80%, 84%, then one can think of the compulsory education in the context of a 30% or 40% turnout. Here we are already getting 80, 84, 90%. Then there is no need. I think we need to double up our efforts for voter education.
Yes, please. Could you introduce yourself when you're...
Oh, all right. My name is Ruby Unger. My feedback. How much of your government budget goes to your commission and to voter education and registration and voting?
Well, the $12 billion would be the cost of entire management of election, which probably is the cheapest anywhere. And voter education, it did not cost us more than a couple of million rupees.
Is that what kind of percentage of your... It's a small percentage of your budget.
Well,
right?
It must have been a 1 or 2%. 1 or 2%.
Got it.
There has been instances in the southern state of Tamil Nadu where the state government actually sponsors color television for a number of residents, and I have actually personally witnessed these color televisions being delivered to the house of citizens just before the elections. And I wonder whether specific voter campaigns are actually utilized or misused by governments that basically purchase elections using color televisions or bags of rice for the poor, more, you know, worse than what they used to.
You know, the law is that you can make any the promises to the voter through a manifesto. That is all legal. But outside the manifesto, if you make any promise or if you are seen giving even $1 to a voter, that is a bribe. And we proceed again. Manifestos, we have no quarrel with. Of course, it's a matter of public debate whether free television or very cheap food grain or a washing machine or a bicycle should be given free. Unfortunately, or fortunately, the Law Election Commission has nothing to do with it. For that, there has to be a separate regulation. Personally, I find nothing wrong with the parties making an announcement through their manifesto. At least the television with the promise reaches the people.
You know, Rajiv Gandhi famously said that if you give 100 rupees for a program, only 15 rupees reach the people. At least in this case, the whole television was reaching. The food grains is reaching there, and the needs of the people are getting met. And if there is a competition, free laptop, free all that, people are benefiting, frankly. But whether it's there is an ethical issue involved, some people say that the political party also has to announce how they're going to fund these extravagant programs. Well, but I think they're more of an academic debate. But people who are receiving all these benefits, well, other parties can also offer the same television. Let them offer a bigger television.
Thank you for this presentation. My name is Mansaf Sheikh Ruhu. I am an elected person in the new parliament constitutional assembly in Tunisia. And we are facing a very, very tough problem with the election commission. The first commission was volunteers, independent. We are here after their work. But now there is a big debate how to ensure the independence of the next commission from the executive branch and from the parliament itself.
Yeah.
So what's the experience of India? It's very dear to us. Discussion is very hot in the parliament in Tunis now.
In fact, as I mentioned, the independence of the commission and neutrality of the commission is of utmost importance. We have been successful because of our fierce autonomy. Of course, it is always a temptation of the government to encroach on our autonomy and to somehow force our hands to do things. But the Supreme Court has been our guardian angel. And any effort by the government to interfere with our work is put down very heavily there by the court. I was invited by Egypt and Jordan. And also we have been in touch with Tunisia. They wanted that indelible ink for marking the finger. So I think there is a lot of learning from our Indian experience. Efforts of the government to browbeat the election commission into submission continue. It is for us to stand up. Fortunately, the constitution, the law, and the judiciary have stood rock solid behind us. And we have been able to lie. For instance, the dates of the elections are announced by us. Nobody else knows. The Prime Minister will be the last to know when the election will be held. So this is to take care of incumbency advantage. They may choose a timing of which suits them, but we don't allow such a thing. And the model code of conduct which we have, it's an interesting device, a voluntary code created by political parties themselves, and the compliance to the code is much more than any law of the land. And even the thought of a notice from us for violation will bring 5% vote down for those leaders. So they're very scared. If there is one institution politicians are scared of in India, it is the election commission.
I'm Michael Kao from Taiwan, dealing with democracy development as well. And earlier, Taiwan was mentioned by Bob. But I think this panel educated me. Really, the heart of the issue is really democracy education or civic education. In the case of India, you have voter education, which really motivate people to vote and know the meaning of voting and democracy. Now, I think, Mr. O'Brien, you have this book, Democracy for All, and it's fascinating me because now, as Bob Lagama mentioned, the Community of Democracy is launching an important effort for democracy education. And it's a complicated topic, but you got to have some basic essence for the education and how to communicate that, essence, to the voters, to the citizens, and so on is very critical. Now, I just wonder, on the basis of your book, Democracy for All, whether you have, a sort of overall evaluation of the effectiveness of the book involved, and how many countries really translate and use. You mentioned Mongolia, I understand, but whether there are any countries who really use a sort of standard textbook for democracy education. And I'd like to see if you can eliminate me more.
A number of things there. You raised some interesting questions. First of all, most textbooks on democracy and civics are very boring and don't teach well at all. Again, I would emphasize what I did in my talk, and that was that only the use of interactive methods where students participate, they get involved in a hands-on kind of way, really work. And there's lots of research that shows that learning by doing is the best way to learn anything. The evaluation of this particular book, not much has really been done, I'll be honest to say, evaluating it. It's more anecdotal where people have said, teachers and others, this really works well with students. And we don't just take the book and translate it. Basically, it's modified, just like I showed you the example of the Snow Leopard. They have put that into their Democracy for All book. They take some of the exercises work just through translation, but most would be modified and adapted to meet the needs of that particular country. But we had to be very careful because we at times would work with people in other countries. There was this law professor from Kazakhstan, as I recall, who got a hold of our book and said, well, I'm going to do this in Kazakhstan. When we got it back, it was in Russian. People said, this is just a Russian textbook. Your methods and all you do in the American Street Law book and the Democracy for All book are not here at all. So it's a delicate process to make a new, because it's changing education. It's changing the way people are taught.
Thanks, Steve Hansen from the College of William and Mary. I have a question for Derry. I was curious about your view. I mean, many people are skeptical of the third-party solution because historically in the United States, typically that's simply led to the victory of the party that was ideologically further from where the third party began, right, from Woodrow Wilson to Clinton. And so people who are focused on the power dimension say, well, I don't want to get started with that because all I'll do is destroy, you know, my chances to support the candidate I'm closest to, and it's quixotic anyway.
Right.
So I was surprised to hear you say that, given your starting point, and was wondering how you would, you know, other people may argue the thing to do is simply try to change the parties since the system is what it is, or introduce proportional representation, you know, something that would change the incentive structure. So what's your view on that?
I believe fundamentally that American voters, and it's particularly true in California, perceive a monopoly or a duopoly and are trying to break it and are trying to send a message and have yet to succeed. And I'll give you examples. In California, one of the many things I couldn't talk about because we don't have a lot of time here is that we have direct democracy. I mean, the American democracy is fundamentally a representative democracy, but any Californian who has an idea can put something on the ballot and then the voters get to vote on it. And I think it's instructive that in California we've had voter-introduced, not legislative measures, measures to have imposed very short term limits, which says, help me, save me from myself, I keep voting for incumbents and I don't want to. Now we have an independent citizens commission that draws the legislative district lines so that they're more competitive, because for the last 10 years we've had essentially no competitive districts. And now we have a primary that's a top two winner primary where, in fact, in the general election in California in November, in 20 out of 120 legislative districts, the two finalists are of the same party, two Democrats or two Republicans. So, for starters, I would submit to you, voters get that this is a monopoly, and they are trying to impose what I would argue are antitrust measures on their own. To me, so that's proof of my thesis, right? Now, here's the practicality of this. Americans elect had essentially an infinite budget. It was a $30 million budget. Would have been on the ballot in all 50 states, but at the end of the day, for reasons that, you know, again, this is a lot of stuff to talk about in a short amount of time, Americans elect failed to get a sufficient number of delegates to come to its own site to meet its own rules to field a candidate. It was all internally imposed, and I argued that we should get a candidate on there anyway. But let me give you an example when I say that there are, in economic terms, very significant barriers to entry for competitors. In California, if you want to change the law and you want to do it yourself, you have to gather 500,000 valid signatures, and then your measure's on the ballot and people vote for it or not. If you want to change the constitution of the state of California, you need 800,000 valid signatures. If you want to simply form a third party to be on the ballot, you have to submit 1.6 million. Okay? So the Republican, and look, I haven't suddenly become a disloyal Democrat. I'm very much a Democrat, but I'm concerned at this point in my life about the process, right? And I would argue that the Democratic and Republican, and this is that's just one example. I mean, the rules that you have to obey to get on the ballot in some states are truly bizarre. I mean, they're offensive. And I would argue that the Democratic and Republican parties agree on one thing, and that is the status quo. Now, the example that I use is the auto industry. Because if you're a baby boomer, your parents grew up all buying Ford or General Motors or Chrysler cars. And as the baby boomers, as we began to mature into car buyers, we really didn't like their choices. And we began to look at things like Datsuns and Fiats, and you know, we forget about Skodas and all kinds of other cars. The first Toyota was the Toyota Crown that went faster backwards and forwards. I think it was very ugly. And there were entrants into the marketplace that failed. But over time, the demand for something different than what we were offered by the American car companies won. In the end, the baby boomers broke through with probably the VW Bug was the one that broke the market open. And so I that may sound, you know, silly to you, but I'm just waiting for the VW Bug. Because voters have demonstrated over and over again they want more choices in America. In California, which is, you know, kind of a cutting-edge place, and we're proud of it, the percentage of the electorate composed of independents and third-party registrants is about to be more than the number of Republicans. And so, I mean, I think that answers you. I just think the trend is inevitable. Americans want choices. They're not being given choices. Ironically, we're in an industry, the political industry. If you look at the recent history of America, we've deregulated everything. We've deregulated airlines, telephones, bus companies, moving companies. Everything's been deregulated except one thing. The only undertaking in the United States of America that in the last 30 years has been significantly more regulated is running for office. Right? And those regulatory schemes are not producing good results. And I think sooner or later, something's going to give.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.